Today is Friday. It's January 29th, 2016. This is John Williams. We are the Mincing Rascals. Here is Steve Bertrand from WGN Radio. Hi, Steve.
Hello, John Williams.
Kristen McQuarrie and Eric Zorn from the Chicago Tribune. They columnists. She an editorial writer, too. Hi, kids.
Hi, John.
It's Friday.
Woo-hoo!
I like how you're singing that, John. That's nice.
Eric is wound up because
John,
he's really...
John, no, wait. You started, John, and everyone sat straight up the way you sort of did that.
It's Friday.
That's the way.
Very Oprah.
Everybody get it did feel a little like that, didn't it? You guys, we're all just all wound up because the Iowa caucuses are Monday.
Yes.
And so the world will finally, maybe all of this, you know, debating and arguing and talking about politicians finally becomes relevant when something begins to happen, and it's about to. Last night, again, we're recording this on Friday, January 29th, but last night the Republicans debated without Donald Trump. I want to start with this question to you all. It's something we've all talked about a lot the last several months. Who do you think is going to win the Republican nomination? Kristen McQuarrie, go.
Trump.
Eric Zorn.
Well, I'd have to say Trump at this point.
That's all you get to say. Okay. Bertrand.
Donald Trump.
Okay. I still say Rubio, but that's me being more hopeful now than practical.
Well,
if
I can just jump in about Trump's decision to skip the debate last night. A lot of people were playing it on the post-debate analysis last night as a smart move by Trump, that he came out looking strong and defiant. I don't think that's the case. I think he ended up looking weak. I thought his event to help veterans was cynical. And I just don't think it helped. I saw some coverage that Ronald Reagan skipped his last debate before Iowa back in 1980 because he thought he had the debate in hand. He had thought the race in hand, and he ended up losing to George W. Bush.
Wait a minute. Are you talking about the Nashua? This I paid for this microphone event.
No, I'm talking
something
about
different.
Iowa. I'm talking about Iowa. And I just don't think it's a smart move to skip debates.
I did. I thought if Fox News put out a press release like they did about Donald Trump, I mean, I think Fox News was totally stepping over the line. They were being snarky and unobjective. We would never do that at the Tribune. We would put out a statement defending, you know, Megyn Kelly or Eric Zorn in a professional manner. I wouldn't have shown up at the debate either.
Okay,
but raised $6 million for veterans. I mean, really, you're going to find a window of criticism in that?
Yeah, you called that cynical, Eric?
Yeah, it was cynical. It definitely was. And then there are veterans groups that really resent him being used as a political pawn like that. But I think that it doesn't look good for him not to be there.
He's in New Hampshire today.
And also the thing is that these press releases from Fox came out after he expressed reservations about being there. It wasn't like they just sent out a news release saying, "Here comes the debate," and
he tweeted out a little poll, "Should I go?" And their reaction was to send out a snarky press release that said, in case you didn't read it, "We've learned from a secret back channel that the Ayatollah and Putin both intend to treat Donald Trump unfairly when they meet with him if he becomes president. A nefarious source tells us that Trump has his own secret plan to replace the cabinet with his Twitter followers to see if he should even go to those meetings." I mean, that is just this. We are talking about a national news network. I just thought they were totally out of line.
They were completely out of line. But still, the question is whether this serves him in trying to get the nomination. And
I don't think that was Roger Ailes, by the way. I thought that was some 23.
Apparently,
well,
I think you're probably right about that, but it doesn't matter.
And
it's
not atypical of their statements. I guess that's what they do.
Yeah.
Well,
but my thing is, so I think it was kind of wise for him not to be there because he is being challenged by Ted Cruz in Iowa. And now Ted Cruz was the biggest punching bag on the stage. So in a way, he protects himself from any major screw-ups, and he subjects his closest rival to the punches from the minions who are there. I think it's interesting that here we are on Friday. He's not in Iowa again. He's in New Hampshire today, and I'm not sure I understand that because polls show him way ahead in New Hampshire, not so much in Iowa. Why is he there today? I don't quite get that.
Yeah, I don't understand that either. But Fox also said that he demanded or asked for $5 million to go to the charity of his choice, maybe that veterans group, in order for him to appear. They said they're not paying him anything, so... That plus the fact that he said it was really hard for Megyn Kelly when, after the last debate, she and he tangled, and he would hate to have her go through that again. So he's
a gentleman. What a gentleman he is.
He's a giver.
I'm screaming at my audience, my microphone, my radio, my newspaper when I follow this stuff. We are about to elect a 9-year-old. It's it's stunning. It gets stunninger every week to me that he says stuff like that.
But he's a 9-year-old savant because
he is.
I mean, everything he does seems to work out for him. I'm interested in this blaming the media thing now. And, you know, they're coming down on Megyn Kelly for her question in the first debate about how he treats women and his views towards women. In the days after that debate, she wasn't subjected to that criticism, right? I mean, that's kind of grown now. And if you listen to the tenor of the questions from the others last night, they were very pointed, very sharp. I still don't think her initial questioning of him was out of line
at
all.
It wasn't out of line. He has said all of those things. I mean, he reacted ridiculously. And I will say, though, last night, the first hour, were kind of, the moderators didn't talk about a single issue. They were just trying to get the panelists to spar with each other. The first question was about Trump, even though he wasn't there. The second half was better, but I thought the first half, too, was I was not impressed. I mean, some of the questions for Rand Paul were about, you know, his father, and Jeb Bush about his brother. I mean, it's the last debate. Can we please talk about issues? They finally did get to it.
I want to circle back to what Steve said. I thought that one of the things that did happen was that, you're right, the focus was not on Trump last night. They tried at the beginning, as Kristen says, the first question was about Trump. But after that, they were saying, hey, he said this about you. You guys want to fight about that?
Right.
And he said, I mean, they were trying to do that. And a lot of the focus got on Cruz and Rubio, who were tearing each other down. And I don't know who comes out ahead on that.
I thought Ted Cruz looked bad last night. I thought he seemed petulant. He said at one point, geez, you know, the last four questions have been, please attack Ted. This is a debate. It's supposed to be a policy issue. Gosh, if you ask one more mean question, I might have to leave the stage.
I think he wrote that. I think he came into the debate with that.
I think he did, too.
He thought it was going to be funny. And it's not being played as funny.
I think he was trying to position himself as, now I'm the big dog.
Well,
look,
and
here's
he
what's
thought,
happened.
I think he thought he was making a joke. And
I took it as a joke. I did.
Did you?
Yeah, I
don't think a lot of people are taking it as a joke.
He doesn't have comedic timing then. I just thought it sounded...
you think?
Like, give him his little...
When I think of comedians, I do not think of Ted Cruz.
I don't know. He's kind of funny.
I saw something on Twitter that I really liked. The guy said, Ted Cruz looks like the gym teacher who yells at you until you start crying and then yells at you for crying.
Here's my thing.
Wow.
I remember when Richard Gephardt, the Missouri congressman, ran for president. And I don't know if it would have been... I don't know exactly if he ran in 2008 or when it was, but he'd bowed out early in the primaries, before Iowa or right after Iowa or something. I think he was banking on Iowa. And I remember after where the pundits and everyone said, you know, he's just a great guy. He's a wonderful guy, and he deserved better. And I'm thinking at the time, why, if you know him and you believe that, what's wrong with saying that in the beginning, you know, before he loses? This guy's a great guy. Of course, you wouldn't do that. I can't believe how many pundits are saying, yeah, Ted Cruz is not likable. Nobody likes Ted Cruz. I mean, they're totally, there seems to be this ability to just, on the part of the pundits and reporters and others, just say, yeah, this is a guy who no one likes.
I don't know that it's even a personality issue, though. I mean, he is really harsh in his policy positions, too. I mean, when they got into discussion about immigration and they talked about this amendment that he introduced at one point, that was basically a poison pill to what had been a reasonable compromise in immigration reform. And his amendment was this: anyone who is here illegally is permanently ineligible for citizenship. I mean, that is just so far out of the mainstream of what Americans, I think, believe. And so it's not just his personality, it's his strident policy positions.
Well, and so he and Rubio really lock horns on that issue and a couple of others. And they go back and forth accusing each other of changing their positions. They even play video of previous votes and how it conflicts with their current views. And I get lost in all of that. And I'm not sure I know how, you know, important that whole thing is, that you had one view at one point and a different view at a different time. Shouldn't you be allowed to have different views at different times depending on the circumstances? Does anybody know really how either of those two guys feel about the immigration issue after all of this?
I think Ted Cruz is as far to the right as you can be when you introduce an amendment like that. Marco Rubio, what they were talking about was the Gang of Eight proposal.
Right.
It was a compromise. You had to be in this country you had to work 13 years towards citizenship. You had to pay all of your back taxes. You had to learn English. You could not have a criminal background. And border security was going to be the first thing that was addressed. I mean, to me, that is a reasonable issue. Marco Rubio should be showcasing that instead of kind of running from it.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that Senator Rubio worked with the opposing party to try to solve a major problem in this country?
I know. Persecute him. Throw him in handcuffs.
You know, every time I see Rubio, I'm impressed with how well-spoken he is. I mean, I know that. I mean, maybe that's really superficial, but he really seems to have a command of the facts, and he speaks in paragraphs.
Yeah, he
does.
And
I think that's a real asset as a politician. I don't know if it's an asset as a president, but I'm always watching, going, man, this guy's impressive.
But I get disappointed in him particularly, and all of them, that so much of those beautiful paragraphs, Eric, are so cynical to the president, Hillary Clinton.
Oh, yeah. I want someone to inspire me. I want aspirational. I want
really,
Bernie Sanders.
Rubio is not that. No. But he's not, is he, Steve?
No.
I mean, Rubio is really good at everything he can tie to a failed policy of Barack Obama. Okay, I guess we're just the junkyard dogs. You know, as much as I've paid attention to this debate series, I get more and more discouraged by the lot of America when I watch these
guys.
Well,
I just want to add one thing, and that is Chris Christie, it seems like, I mean, he's so, between him and Cruz, they are so ready to drop bombs and attack people and just militarize our country. I mean, I don't think that's where the public
For
is.
For example, how is he going to be able to keep Hillary 10 miles from the White House? Can he do that legally?
Yeah, right. I know. Well, or their pronouncements about ISIS. You know, ISIS will be running if I get to be president. And I don't know what that's supposed to mean. By the way, Steve, at the end of our debate last week, you said, gee, I was hoping that we were going to talk about Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And I didn't tell you I was going to bring that up again today or prep you for that. But was there something on your mind this week or last that you wanted to say about the Democratic
side?
Well,
it shows you how quickly things change. But last week, as we sat down, was just when his Simon and Garfunkel ad came out.
Which
you
was
know,
brilliant,
to look for a
by
miracle.
The way.
And it you know, gave me goosebumps.
Me too.
It took you 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw? That's a terrible hitchhiking
record. By the way,
it's
a terrible way to vote for president. What, vote for Bernie Sanders because you like that Simon and Garfunkel song?
And maybe it's a terrible way, but it's, you know, and it's easier because he's in the party in power, so he can't go negative like the party out of power would. But, you know, at least he's giving his supporters something to believe in, something to lift them up.
And what is that?
A great 60s song.
Hogwash.
No, you know what? It may be. I'm not even going to argue, his stuff.
Money rains from heaven.
And really?
Kristen does want to argue his stuff.
Some of the memes out there about Bernie's positions are pretty funny, but I don't know, Kristen, just because he's got a whatever kind of view that is, that's that troubling to you? You're that cynical about Bernie's vision?
I'm not cynical. The math does not exist. We are $18 trillion in debt. We're going to be crushed by the debt. And actually, it's much higher than that if you consider pensions and health care and all the other things that we have taken on. We can't have his Medicare for all.
He's the liberal version of Donald Trump when Trump says, we'll build the wall and Mexico will pay for it, right?
Yeah, but we're not going to get his medical plan any more than we're going to get Donald Trump's wall. So I don't, that stuff doesn't bother me. Here's why I like Bernie Sanders right now, you guys. Respond to this. I am more concerned about income inequality in this country than I am ISIS and immigration. That's all the Republicans want to talk about, and that's all Bernie Sanders wants to talk about. And neither of them seem to be talking much about the other guy's topic. What Bernie is talking about is, I think, much more relevant to everybody, income inequality.
Here's the thing. If the Republicans want Bernie Sanders to win in Iowa and win the nomination, all they have to do is have Donald Trump release his taxes, because Trump has said he's going to release his taxes eventually. And when he did it, an interview I saw, he said, you know, like everyone else, I try to pay as little as possible. So what that tells me is he's going to come in at a rate that's lower than what most of us pay. Because the system is rigged for the rich.
Maybe an amount that's lower than most of us pay.
Well, I don't know about
yeah, that. Would really
clever
be,
accountants.
That would really be sad.
But I just think if he comes out and says, you know, that this gazillionaire paid at a 10% or 12% rate, that just speaks to everything Bernie Sanders is saying.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I can't wait for that number to come out, because just the way he sort of said, you know, I try to pay as little as possible, I just think there's something there.
No charity.
Right.
It'll be really.
He's a 74-year-old socialist. See, secular.
Trump or Sanders?
No, Sanders.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I mean, he's just not going to win. If he gets nominated, he's going to lose all 50 states. The Republicans have been very nice to him because they are hoping, they've got their fingers crossed that he's nominated. Because they will, no matter who they nominate,
don't you think the same way that Democrats want Trump to win?
Oh, yes.
Yes. I mean, they are both appealing to the same cause. They're both looked at as genuine, authentic. They're tapping into frustration. I mean, as far apart as they are on issues, Trump and Bernie, they're similar.
Except Sanders, I think, is younger. The support. I mean, I've got two very young voters in my house who I think, you know, are feeling the burn.
Yeah, I thought you meant younger. I'm like, no, he's 74 and Trump is 68.
But, you know, and I was talking to my son about it. He goes, well, why couldn't Bernie Sanders win? I said, 8 years ago, the Republicans who hated President Obama were trying to call him a socialist. Bernie Sanders calls himself a socialist. I mean,
don't,
you know, he takes
Steve,
on the
name. I hope you're not blowing out that little candle, because I'm serious about that. I think we have to stop worrying about the label and listen to the message.
I agree with you, John, but the voters aren't going to agree with you.
We won't.
It is just impractical. I mean, I hate to be, you know, this sort of cynical, cold.
We are a socialist country. We saved the banks.
We don't use the word, John. We don't use that word. We
think about what we did under a Republican administration and a Democratic administration to save businesses that we thought were too big to fail. We took money from the taxpayers and we gave it to private companies. And I don't know what the payback rate has been. I think it's been pretty good. But I mean, what is Social Security? What is income distribution and taxes? That's what we do.
No,
it's just a label.
And I'm for universal health care coverage. I like the idea of extending the public education model up through college. I like the things that he says. I just feel like that the cost of nominating him for president is going to be four to eight more years of a Republican in the White House appointing Supreme Court justices. And I mean, I hate to be like hard-headed and cynical about it, but the Democrat, I mean, I kind of wish Joe Biden were running. I don't know if Hillary Clinton's going to survive legally. I've been reading all these things about her email scandal. It seems like it's worse than maybe we thought.
I mean, look, you know, John, the word liberal has been banned in politics now.
Yeah,
people are progressive. They're not liberal.
You're not even supposed to be elite.
Just imagine socialist. You know, if we can't utter the word liberal now,
I'm going to vote for him just to spite that notion.
Just to spite us is what he's going to do.
Let's talk a little bit about Illinois and Chicago politics. Eric, let's start with Governor Rauner and what's going on in Springfield and Chicago right now.
Well, he gave the State of the State speech on Wednesday, and he extended some olive branches, and also he slapped some hands while his hand was out there. It was people saw it as maybe a chance for him to reset his relationship, which is very poisonous, with Speaker Madigan and Senate President Cullerton and Mayor Emanuel. There was some of that in his rhetoric, but on the other hand, a lot of it was just, you know, the same old blaming the unions, blaming the Democratic rule for all the problems that Illinois has. And, you know, whether you agree with that or not, it didn't seem like a way they did not press the reset button, I didn't think.
Too little, too late, guys, maybe? Is that it?
Well, it can't be too late. We got stuff to get done.
Yeah, he's still the governor.
It's a speech. I mean, let's see what kind of legislation or actual action comes out of it. I never really get too excited about speeches. I do think he keeps stepping on himself when he goes after unions so stridently. You know, I'm okay with him being tough with AFSCME at the negotiating table. But when he says, when he throws out that red meat, and he actually got booed for it by saying, you know, I know you're all controlled by the unions and the trial lawyers. You know, that's just, that's not helpful. That is just not helpful. If the blame should be split out, I still put it more on Mike Madigan, who has refused to give on anything. And he had one of his members rebelled and is now kind of splitting from the caucus and not giving Madigan that 71st vote and saying a lot of the things that we've all been saying, that, you know, he's been down there for 45 years.
It's hard to say much in defense of Madigan, because he won't really come out and defend himself in terms of putting forth his own agenda. I wrote about this a week ago, and I continue to harp on it, which is that the Democrats have not been advancing their own agenda here. I mean, ask Mike Madigan. He just says, well, I want to be reasonable. I don't want to negotiate in the extreme. But what is his answer to the problems, the real problems that are plaguing Illinois? I don't know the answer to that.
His answer is to keep letting the problems build up for three more years so that when Lisa Madigan, his daughter, runs, Bruce Rauner is in a very difficult position.
I don't know.
That's what I think.
You really think that, Kristen?
Yeah, I think he's not going to let this governor have anything in his win column. And he's going to let social services and the most vulnerable suffer.
So the name Madigan is going to be golden in Illinois in 3 years? I can't believe that. That seems like a terrible strategy.
No, Lisa Madigan is extremely popular. She polls just behind Jesse White statewide in terms of popularity.
Yeah, but wait till it's kind of like how Bernie Sanders beats everybody in these national polls because nobody really knows about. I think when you start putting that Madigan name into the mix.
Who in Illinois is more popular than Lisa Madigan statewide?
Well, Jesse White.
Jesse White is quite popular. But she's popular, but she's not. She doesn't.
But
really,
I mean, she's right up there, though, isn't she?
She's popular because she doesn't. She doesn't take any really controversial stance.
She's under the radar.
I would like to know what her plan is. If you were to ask her today, what would you do if you were governor? She would say, "Well, I'm not the governor. I'm the attorney general."
Well, but that's a fair statement. I mean, really, what she's doing right now, she's in a good position to be popular. But also, it's nobody's business, including hers, what her plan is to save Illinois. She's not the. She doesn't get a vote.
You're right about that, but that's why I'm very skeptical that she either could be elected governor at this point.
Boy, I like her. I always have. I think she could be president of the United. Wasn't she on somebody's list of rising female stars who've got a shot someday?
That sounds like something I would do.
One other subject here that's more tragic than all of this, and that is John Cass wrote a piece the other day in the Chicago Tribune about the total number of murders in Chicago and the total number of people shot. We're outpacing last year. And I'll tell you my view from Minnesota, and I know Chicago. I've lived there. I love that city. I still do a show there, blah, blah, blah. Those numbers are high. And he's putting a lot of that on Rahm Emanuel. And I wonder what you guys think about that. Is this maybe fair to put on the mayor of the city?
That is such a tough question because in a lot of ways, I mean, the buck stops with the mayor. So he does deserve, when the city is successful, he gets to reap the benefit of that. And when crime statistics are terrible, he has to, wear the jacket for that too.
Yeah, unfortunately, when you are in a position like the mayor and you are claiming credit when you get in front of your constituents and say crime is down,
CTA crime is down.
That when you make those kind of claims, then you own it when the crime goes back up again. I think that this is probably part of more of this national phenomenon they call the Ferguson effect, that police officers are more afraid to make the stop and frisk and to seize the guns. I mean, one of the interesting statistics, I don't know if it was in John's column or where it says, but that the gun seizures are way down. And when your gun seizures are down, that means the guns are out there, which means they're getting used, and so it may be starting there. But if the police are hanging back where they used to be more aggressive because
right.
they're afraid of all this kind of publicity, I don't know if you can pin that on the mayor because that's more of a national phenomenon.
And it might not be his fault, but it could be his responsibility. How's that?
Yeah, oh boy, that's very good, Steve. Hey, by the way, what did you guys think of the story about the people that are panhandling at was it Daly Plaza? And the county deputies tell them, come on, move along. You can't be doing that here. And they sued, and they won $1,500 judgments.
That's like 2 days.
Yeah, that is a lot of heroin.
Really?
I'm
really?
Kidding.
That's
I'm joking.
So mean.
I'm joking.
I thought it was interesting because I wonder what people want. Do you want the sheriff's deputies to not allow people in prominent public places like that, say Millennium Park or Daly Plaza, do you want them to sort of, clean the area of people sleeping in bags or panhandling?
This is another tough one, but I think if it's just people panhandling, it's fine. I mean, we can't hide all of our baggage. We have a homelessness problem in this city, and it is out front every day. If you're panhandling at Daly Plaza or outside the Tribune, I mean, that's part of life in a big city. Where I do think that law enforcement needs to get involved, there are some places on the northwest side where they've built like tent cities underneath overpasses. And then I think you do have to get them to, you can't have a whole encampment of people living by high, by traffic areas. But otherwise, I mean, I'm always sort of for the little guy, I think. And so, more power to them. $15.
Right. It's one thing to go after them if they're being aggressive or bothersome to people. And there are some of those around on South Michigan Avenue and elsewhere. But if they're just asking for a handout, I mean, it's a public spot, right?
$1,500 does sound like a lot of money. And maybe it's not what they would normally have made that day. Maybe it's, a little punitive that way.
Well, the government's going to take 35%.
If it were
does that count as income? Holy cow!
If it were Michael Jordan, it would have been $8 million.
Well, that's funny. But that's funny because I'm sure panhandlers don't report their income. It's a cash transaction. But I guess
their income is below the taxable threshold.
It's funny, Eric. You bring that up on the radio, and a lot of people think the panhandlers, if they've got a good corner, make a lot of money.
I'm not going to sit here and allow you to impugn the integrity of panhandlers. I'm sure even if it's a cash transaction, if they need to report, they'll report.
Oh, yeah, right, Steve. Yeah, sure, that'll happen. Okay, I think that's the end of this edition of the Mincing Rascals. We're going to close, as we always do, with our recommendations for the week, something we've seen, read, or been listening to that we think you might enjoy as well. Bertrand's been jumping up and down since we started this one.
Because really I never have anything.
He wants to tell you about what, Steve?
The Geography of Genius. It's a book by Eric Weiner. And in fact, there's been some give and take in the Tribune. I think he wrote a piece, and then Kelly Leonard wrote a contrary piece. But he's at my Steve Bertrand on Books podcast at WGNRadioPlus.com, WGN Plus. But he went to different spots in the world at where different times in history there were moments of genius, like Renaissance Florence or Athens or Vienna at the time of Mozart and leading into Beethoven, and said, what do these areas have in common? Silicon Valley. And so he tried to find, and it's relevant because, you know, we talk a lot about innovation districts and how people try to create this area of geography where innovation will blossom. Well, he kind of looked at areas where that's happened through history and had some sort of fascinating conclusions, mostly that, moments of tumult or cataclysm led to these things. Like, it was a terrible time in Athens before it flourished. Often they are led by immigrants, people who are alien to the area. The musicians in Vienna weren't Viennese, by and large. They came to Vienna from elsewhere. That's very similar in Silicon Valley. A lot of the people who led the innovation there were foreign-born or certainly not from the area of California. So it's called The Geography of Genius by Eric Weiner, and I enjoyed it a lot.
It sounds fascinating. The only thing that makes me I'm skeptical about is what's the value of going to Athens today in the 2000s
to learn about what happened then,
to walk the streets to get a sense of what happened 3,000 years ago or whenever. I was skeptical of that.
I think he enjoys travel. With Edinburgh
too. The publisher pays for some of that.
But part of it is a little travelogue to the book. I mean, he writes about seeing Edinburgh Castle for the first time, which a city that flourished during the Age of Enlightenment. So it's kind of a very accessible, friendly sort of tourism/genius book.
Yeah, I had it in my hand at the bookstore the other day and put it down, but what a great concept. I thought maybe that's kind of a contrived notion, but now I'm back in, Steve. Maybe I'll go ahead and pick that one up.
Check it out.
Erica, what are you on to this week?
I'm recommending something called Morning Spin, which is a new email newsletter from the Tribune. It's our political team puts out every morning, and it used to be just a feature online. You have to go hunt for it. But just in the last couple of days, they've made it an email feature, so you can have it delivered to your mailbox. I'm a big believer in these morning digest briefing emails that come out, and this is a new addition to that. And
Morning Spin?
Morning Spin at chicagotribune.com/newsletter.
And as a news guy, I use it every day.
Do you really?
Absolutely. It sets the table for the day.
Huh. Kristen, what are you liking this week?
Well, Eric tells me I'm supposed to every week say that you need to read Eric Zorn's column. That's what I heard.
He sure does when you're not here.
Yeah.
He really plugs you, him. Yeah.
Actually, I just finished a book called Going for Broke. I will not bore you with all the details, but it frames a lot of what I think Americans are feeling about the presidential race. And it's just mostly math. And I won't bore you, but let me read this to you. Even at the deficit's low point in 2015, the federal government will still be borrowing almost 13 cents out of every dollar that it spends. And China is now the United States' largest foreign creditor, holding 10% of our public debt. That's why I think it's, the biggest issue facing our country.
Who wrote this?
Michael Tanner.
Going for Broke. My recommendation is American Idol. It's the last season.
Playing the role of Kristen this week.
I know.
I'll tell you what, though. Maybe it is why I so enjoy it. Because with all of these issues and politics and whatnot, that show is so sweet anymore. The candidates are so genuine and talented and, some better than others, right? And if you'd watched the last few weeks, you saw where they're just going from city to city and talking to kids and hearing their talents. And I like the judges. I like Ryan Seacrest. And I like these faces of 16, 18, 22-year-old kids who are singing their hearts out. And we end up crying at most of the episodes at some point.
My goodness.
Now they moved on to Hollywood, and it's ratcheting up. And it's just a good show. It's the last season for it. And if you went away because it's been such a long run, I'll recommend that you come back because it's, I still think, very good TV.
It's not really a cultural phenomenon anymore, right? We don't talk about,
you're right,
you know, who's going to win. I don't hear those kind of conversations anymore.
Right, yeah. We've done that with shows like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Everybody was talking about that. We couldn't believe it. Donald Trump's show was such a hit. It was so fun, and he was even likable. Remember that? Well, do you remember when we liked Donald Trump as a TV host?
I think we're in the 18th season of Survivor.
Yes,
exactly.
I was just going to say, yeah. I remember watching the first season or two.
We knew them by name. We knew them all.
This is a new sport. This is going to be the greatest thing, and now I'm stunned to see that it's still on. People are still watching it.
I'm amazed as well. I feel that way about The Bachelor and Bachelorette series. How that survived the second season, I don't know. And though, Kristen, you don't really.
That's so unfair.
Kristen.
I watched some of the early seasons, but I have since, you know, if you want to watch people get drunk and fight and make out in hot tubs, it's good TV.
Well, I think though.
When's it on?
That's become now the Housewives of, you know, that whole franchise.
Another of my favorite shows.
Yeah. I
wonder if anyone's saying this about the Mincing Rascals. Like, I can't believe that's still on.
I would hope so.
That's Eric Zorn, Steve Bertrand, and Kristen McQuarrie. You can find Eric Zorn in the Chicago Tribune and at chicagotribune.com/Zorn. You read Kristen's column there and also editorials. And Steve Bertrand at Steve Bertrand on Books, Steve Bertrand Travel, and at WGN Radio. This is John Williams. I'm King John on Facebook. Remember, you can always listen to us as well at WGNplus.com. Get the WGN Plus app on your phone. You can hear us there. Maybe another easy way for you to do it is to subscribe to us on iTunes. Thank you, Bob Ferguson, for being our engineer, and Kristen Decker is our producer. And we'll drop another podcast next Friday.
You little rascal, you! You little rascal, you!
It's Friday.
That's the way.
It's very Oprah.
Everybody get. It did feel a little like that, didn't it?
Please welcome our favorite.